It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So with the commercial space boom underway and the proliferation of satellite networks, the sheer amount of junk orbiting the planet poses an increasing threat of collisions. We look at orbit litter, what it means for generations to come. Call in with what's on your mind about space debris. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Ruth Rand is an assistant professor of history at California Institute of Technology, or Caltech. She is a historian of science, technology, and the environment. Lisa Ruth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It feels like a homecoming.
Well, it is in part with your Wisconsin connections.
So, yes.
So the UN General Assembly passes this non-binding resolution to stop conducting direct ascent anti-satellite tests. What are the concerns with these practices?
So these direct anti-satellite tests, what that means, it's kind of just what it sounds like, right? Sending a projectile from the ground to outer space to basically blow up a satellite. And this has happened a few times over the course of history, of the course of the space age. It began early in the space age in the 1960s, and then again, it started up again in the new millennium, first with the destruction of a Chinese weather satellite by the Chinese government. The United States followed suit the next year by blowing up one of our own defense satellites. And then again, starting in 2019, India sent an ASAT to one of its satellites on the eve of a presidential election. And then just last year, Russia blew up one of its satellites in an ASAT test. So the concern about this is that with each of these ASATs, these individual satellites get broken up into thousands and thousands of smaller pieces that are all moving very, 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 very quickly. And each of those pieces at each of those high velocities can serve as a dangerous projectile, threatening satellites, human spacecraft like the International Space Station, and the like, because each of those whirring pieces, whether they're tiny pieces or larger pieces, can really pack a destructive punch. So it's causing a lot of dangerous waste to be produced in the orbital environment.
So when you look at the sources of this, all this space junk, all of this large orbital debris, is it satellites that are the largest extent of this problem, or what can you pin it to as the principal source?
So there's lots of stuff up there. Depending on what point in time we're looking at, right? There are things like rocket bodies. So basically, expended pieces of the rockets that launch our spacecraft into space. And when I say "our," of course, I'm referring to a growing, but otherwise ultimately very small number of, you know, nations and private companies with the power and resources to do so. Pieces of rockets that can also be dangerous because they might still have some fuel in them, for example. Satellites that are no longer functioning, but also just the debris that comes from the decay of these objects, right? I mean, they are subjected to environmental forces like any other infrastructure on the ground that we might see here. They require maintenance, but there's not really currently much of a good way to maintain those satellites. So it can be debris can be created from destructive forces like a rocket body accidentally exploding, or an ASAT, or just the shedding of pieces of a spacecraft through normal operation, like paint flecks or screws or any number of things. I mean, there's even great pieces of debris like lost tools that astronauts have accidentally dropped or purposely put into the space environment. But the most concerning things are these, things like ASATs, but also these things like rocket bodies that when they're no longer being controlled can be extremely dangerous. And in our current era, with the rise of reusable rockets, or at least rockets with reusable first stages, some of that risk is decreasing, but we're also seeing a dramatic increase in the number of launches. So we have more and more and more operational things in orbit than we did even 5 years ago. So the risk is decreasing in some ways and rising in others.
We're looking at the pollution and the politics of space junk with Caltech Assistant Professor of History Lisa Ruth Rand as our guide. You can join in on space garbage and what you want to know about it. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So is Wisconsin or any other place more vulnerable to, like, reentering debris? I mean, you know, posing a risk to people or buildings, whether it's here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, you know, what is the risk?
So this is something that I feel like comes up every couple of years, right, where something is reentering. Actually, when I was last living in Wisconsin for my postdoc, towards the end, a piece of a Chinese space station was reentering, and there was kind of a concerns that the potential reentry path passed over Wisconsin, right? And ultimately, it didn't. It fell into the ocean, like the majority of uncontrolled reentries. And I should note here that, you know, often when this happens, that means it is an object that operators in the ground are no longer able to communicate with, and no longer able to direct its motion. The vast majority of reentering objects, I should say the vast majority, the a lot of the reentering objects that are being controlled, operators typically try to drop them into this point in the Pacific Ocean called Point Mimos. There's an actual satellite graveyard and rocket body graveyard in this in part of the ocean. But that said, Wisconsin does have a really interesting history with orbital debris and with space, the space industry in general. That's something that I really recommend listeners look into. There's a rich history from the space industry in Wisconsin, including in Madison. But in 1962, a piece of a Soviet satellite, Sputnik 4, crash landed into Manitowoc. And a fragment of that was recovered. And, you know, it's become, there's now annually a Sputnik Fest festival in Manitowoc. Yes, it's great. A really wonderful kind of kitschy, great thing to attend in September every year for those who are interested. So occasionally things do fall over land, and that's really scary. But for the most part, things do tend to fall into the ocean. That said, it's worth paying attention to. Just last month, a Chinese Long March rocket fell back to Earth in an uncontrolled manner, and there was, again, concern about where it might land. It did fall into the ocean, but that still raises the concerns about, you know, that the need to be really careful and intentional about cleaning up after ourselves in orbit.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, you've also said that the consequences of this space junk largely falling on countries that don't participate in space exploration. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So, while, again, the vast majority of objects have fallen into unpopulated areas and the ocean, or more particularly, more specifically into the ocean, the occasional recovery of debris from land raises concerns, because the majority of those objects have been recovered from regions of the planet that don't have active use of satellites, whether that was kind of the Arctic in the lands of the Dene Inuit people in the late 1970s, or the recovery of fragments of debris from parts of South America. A piece of John Glenn's rocket was recovered in South Africa. These objects, this is really a quirk of the orbits that are being used and the kind of the launch trajectories of these satellites, but or of these rockets. But for the most part, right, the number of recovered fragments have been mostly clustered in the regions of the global south and areas where satellite use is not as high. That said, also the proliferation of junk also makes it really harder for those nations and regions who want to become more active in the space industry, want to operate satellites. It makes it much harder for them to get started. It makes it much more dangerous for them to operate. So really, this is doing harm to kind of this a more global, equitable approach to the use of what's truly a global commons.
Caltech space junk historian Lisa Ruth Rand, our guide to what happens to objects launched into space and the future of the graveyard space orbit. Join in with your questions about space debris, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss space garbage, all the debris left by people in space, and the ever-increasing risk of collisions as countries launch more satellites. Call in at 800-642-1234. Share what you think about the bits of debris and the self-policing nature of dealing with space waste. Caltech historian Lisa Ruth Rand is our guide to the effects of this waste since the dawn of the space age and stays with us. Lisa Ruth, NASA is reporting more than 9,000 metric tons of space junk is orbiting the Earth. So for spacecraft like the, say, the International Space Station that we're familiar with, does it maneuver around this debris? Are spacecraft built to withstand the encountering all this litter?
Spacecraft are built to address the debris environment in space. For, you know, most are built with shielding, particularly on the kind of the leading edges of the satellites, right? The direction that they're orbiting, because it's not just debris. There's micrometeoroids. There's lots of naturally occurring material also in outer space that these satellites do need to be protected from. That said, the International Space Station, right? Periodically, astronauts have to take shelter in Soyuz or Dragon capsules every time there's a close call with debris, because again, like I mentioned earlier in the program, if a piece of quickly moving debris were to make contact with this space station, it could cause catastrophic results and threaten the lives of those astronauts. And that happened in the case of the Russian ASAT last year. That said, right, it's there's a recent news item that the brand new JWST, the brand new space telescope that's way out in Lagrange Point, recently had a kind of an impact with its mirror. Now, that was almost definitely naturally occurring debris, but it kind of illustrates the potential for damage done to satellites that don't have the exactly right kind of shielding to protect against these quickly moving objects. And also, you know, it's not just the space station, right? There's satellites that you and I and a lot of people listening use every day that need to be protected against debris, and that shielding is helpful for small things. But if it's a large thing, then no amount of shielding is really going to help. There's just going to be a collision and the creation of more debris.
So as space becomes more crowded with these satellites that you talk about, the rockets, more, you know, commercial space flights, more people, who's responsible for how you regulate what you can just leave in space?
It's a very good question. Right now, there's really no international binding rules towards the control that regulate the creation of debris. For the most part, it's really up to the goodwill of different organizations, institutions, companies to handle their debris. This recent anti-ASAT resolution that passed by the UN this week, that isn't even binding, right? And a lot of the biggest space actors, including Russia and China, didn't they were against it. India abstained, right? So all the nations that have conducted ASATs, of all the nations that have conducted ASATs, only the United States, which had already resolved. Vice President Kamala Harris had announced this a month ago, resolved to stop doing ASATs. The United States was the only one to sign that resolution. So, you know, there is this kind of, you know, there are efforts to kind of establish norms, but so far in actuality, right, this is still up to good faith. I mean, operators in space should not want there to be a lot of mess in outer space, because that threatens their ability to operate, whether it's a private company like SpaceX or Blue Origin, or, state space operators or international mm-hmm. space operators. It's in everyone's best interest to keep space clean. And yet we still have these things like ASATs that fly counter to that kind of logical conclusion that good faith actors will act in good faith.
Why are private companies launching objects into space?
That's a good question. I mean, there's private companies are largely kind of are becoming extremely more powerful actors in the space age. I mean, during kind of the days of Apollo, right? That's sort of what a lot of folks think of as like the halcyon days of the space age, right? Only governments had the resources, the capital, the power to launch something as large as a rocket and a spacecraft. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, you know, companies helmed by wealthy individuals, again, like SpaceX or Blue Origin, those are gaining more and more stature. And I want to make sure I'm very clear that private companies have been involved in the space industry, particularly the American space industry, for, you know, since the beginning, right? It's not like large private companies were not involved in the construction of spacecraft and rockets. It's just different now in that there's a degree of independence that the current private companies like SpaceX, like Blue Origin, like Rocket Lab have to operate. We kind of see this. I think a really good example of kind of the difference between these two is a couple of years ago, SpaceX launched a test version of a rocket, and the payload on it was a cherry red Tesla convertible. Which, as listeners might know, Tesla is another company of SpaceX CEO Elon Musk. Right, and that payload could have been anything, right? What if it was some kind of other experimental spacecraft, but instead it was a car that was a great advertisement for Tesla. There's an economic incentive to do it, but I think there's also, I think that the leaders of these companies, whether it's Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, they're also just really obsessed with outer space. I mean, I can relate, right? I grew up being a spaceman too. Kind of the idea of just having this being responsible for and helming a space program is something that really demonstrates a lot of things, including just the kind of the outsized power of these individuals and their ability to do something that prior to now only governments could do. But if you're a billionaire, this is something that you now can do. You can have your own kind of boutique space program all of your own.
Talking about space junk, who is responsible for cleaning it up? We have Caltech Assistant Professor of History, Lisa Ruth Rand, and you can join in the conversation along the way, 800-642-1234. Shelley is here from Burlington. Hi, Shelley. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a comment and a question. One, I think we need to kind of change our attitude that the ocean, it has this endless ability to absorb any waste that we want to get rid of. We just dump it in the ocean and it disappears, and that's okay. Especially space junk, which has a lot of hazardous substances associated with it, even after it has come through the atmosphere. And I'm hoping that maybe the space industry is looking at doing something else. And then my question is, can or why not send it out into space or into the sun instead?
Great question, Shelley. Thank you. Lisa Ruth.
Shelley, thank you so much for calling with both that comment and that question. It's really reassuring to hear that, folks are thinking about this, because I mean, I think about it all the time. Obviously, it's my job, but like you are absolutely right that this idea of the ocean as this consequence-free sink for hazardous waste, It happens in kind of more familiar terrestrial contexts with industrial effluent, but it also happens with the deposition of spacecraft. And I should also note that it's not just the ocean, it's also the atmosphere, right? With the atmosphere is also huge and seemingly endless, right? Boundless. But at the same time, a lot of when objects re-enter the atmosphere, a large part of them dissipate into the atmosphere. That's not something that maybe is as measurable as, say, an object falling into the ocean. But it's worth thinking about, and the increased tempo of launches is already kind of starting to measurably change our atmosphere. So that's really important to keep in mind. The question of why not to send it out into space or into the sun is also a good one. So there is one way of managing orbital debris is actually the use of so-called graveyard orbits. So areas designated for the deposition of objects that are no longer in use. And that requires, of course, the satellites and spacecraft to be operational, to be able to be controlled by operators on the ground. But those objects can be boosted to those graveyard orbits and left there to kind of languish and to stay away from currently used orbits. The idea of launching stuff into the sun is an interesting one. That's actually kind of a and not just for, I mean, orbital debris is one thing. It would be difficult, right, with objects that are things like a satellite, right? You'd have to have the right kind of thruster to kind of move it into the right trajectory to get it, to an accurate course to the sun. That's one challenge. But I just so because it might be of interest, in the course of my work, I've seen perennial proposals for solutions to things like nuclear waste, right? Where, the storage of nuclear waste from, say, power plants, right? Mm-hmm. That's been a long question. There have been, every so often you'll see a proposal, we should just shoot it into the sun. Which there are many points where that could be of concern, right? The launch, what if something goes wrong with the launch? What if something goes wrong in orbit, right? But every so often someone will propose this is a solution. Let's get rid of our nuclear waste by shooting it to the sun. And there are lots of challenges presented by that and by presented by trying to move our orbital debris into a path of collision with the sun.
Lisa Ruth Rand is an assistant professor of history at California Institute of Technology and a space junk researcher in particular. Join in with your questions about the stuff in Earth's orbit, how you feel about it on the ground where you are in the Midwest, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the space economy taking off, it poses a greater risk for space junk hurtling through the atmosphere and for space debris to crash land on Earth. Bring your questions and what concerns you about the proliferation of space waste. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Ruth Rand is an assistant professor of history at California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, studying the history of orbitable debris, stays with us. So Lisa Ruth, you know, you have thoughts on the intersection of the climate crisis here. And what are global leaders doing differently when handling climate change versus space junk?
That's a really good question, Kate. There's a lot of similarities in some ways in that, you know, the complexity of these are both global environmental threats, right? Climate change, orbital debris, they're both international in nature. They both require across the board buy-in I shouldn't use the word stakeholders because really it's everyone, right? Everyone on the earth is invested in, or should be invested, right, in making sure that the planet is inhabitable and making sure that the orbital infrastructure is still functioning and is that, you know, we still have a sustainable orbital environment. That means that it's also very, very complicated, right? Because whenever you have any sort of international effort, you have to make sure that that rules, regulations, guidelines are copacetic with each kind of national set of legal regimes, right? Each form of national sovereignty, making sure that everyone is on board and that there's no kind of pushing up against each kind of specific set of regimes and norms and laws. We're just bringing up the UN resolution that just happened, right? It's not always easy to get everyone on board. If there's any sort of resistance, a nation can just decide we're not going to be on board for this. That said, you know, every so often there's a successful analog to point to. And one of the ones that I really like to point to is the Montreal Protocol, that addressed the thinning of the ozone layer that protects the planet from harmful UV light from the sun. Ultimately, this is kind of really one of the few truly successful efforts to address a global environmental harm. This took place in the 80s, and we are seeing, right, that the ozone depression healing itself because of the reduction of CFCs, because importantly, right, the regulations put out in the Montreal Protocol took into account that less powerful developing nations would have some exceptions and, you know, be accounted for in needing to shift technological practices to make sure that that these chlorofluorocarbons that were causing the destruction of the ozone layer would be reduced. So it's extremely challenging. It's hard to create binding rules. It's subject to political whim, but every so often there is a case of a successful example. And I think we can learn a lot from examples like the Montreal Protocol, even for something like the regulation of outer space.
But, you know, space junk doesn't have that emotional tug. Like, I can't see right. It in my mind's eye like I would see an animal affected by climate change, floating away from land. Is that an obstacle?
Absolutely. So there's the heartstrings part of it. But I would say, honestly, having a one, you know, watching a polar bear floating on an ice floe still hasn't really been enough for there to be concrete, you know, sustainable action on, right, on climate change. It's because it's so hard. It's a, you know, cluster of outcomes that we're seeing, right? Weather, we're both currently in Washington, D.C. and in Wisconsin seeing weather events, not that those are necessarily climate change specific, but, right, like, that said, right, there could be also other ways of, so, you know, personal impact can make a difference. So going back to the Montreal Protocol as an example, I mentioned that this took place in the 80s, right, which is kind of surprising when you think about it. This was the Reagan era, this was the Thatcher era, right, of high anti-regulation. Mm-hmm. And yet this was when this happened. And there's, what's fascinating about that was that it's not so much about, you know, that the ozone layer isn't necessarily a charismatic image, right? But we could see it using information from outer space, like kind of a these in real-time models of showing this depression growing over the years. So thanks to our satellites, right, we were able to see that happening. But also the effects of the thinning of the ozone layer were something that these two major leaders who were involved in the protocol could understand. Margaret Thatcher was a bench chemist before she went into politics, and Ronald Reagan, importantly, had skin cancer some five times by the time of the Montreal Protocol. So for him, this was something that he actually could understand in his very body, right? What the risk was of an ozone layer that was damaged. And a lot of people, particularly people with lighter skin, right, know someone who's had skin cancer. It's something that's very relatable and something that, you know, you want to protect your family members, your friends from getting this horrible illness. So, you know, let's push for reducing CFCs. I remember when I was a kid, you know, you go to the hairspray aisle and it says no CFCs. Okay, you know that hairspray is okay to buy, right? Mm. Even though ultimately, you know, individual consumer items like that weren't the major, contribution to this. It still was something where you could feel like, okay, I'm doing something to actually make a difference here. And the kind of the question becomes how can these powerful leaders, right? Is there a way to, you know, understand how, you know, for climate change, right, that that's could personally affect them in the same way, and personally affect kind of individuals who maybe aren't thinking about this on a regular basis, to actually buy in and care and push for change. Same thing with orbital debris in outer space, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing where, I mean, you and I are speaking to each other right now thanks to satellites, right?
Mm-hmm. Good point.
You use satellites, exactly, right? Like we. Practices big and small, taking money out of an ATM, right? Navigating, taking a flight on a commercial airline, any number of things, any sort of financial transactions, they all require on services from satellites. Being able to understand the weather systems that are coming in to Wisconsin, coming into DC, where I am, right? This is something we really increasingly rely on satellites for. So we really should care. But so far, there hasn't been the kind of loss of services that kind of an everyday user like you or me would notice. And my concern is, you know, if that happens, it might be too late to start caring.
Lisa Ruth Rand with us as we talk about the space race, the space junk orbiting the Earth, Caltech Assistant Professor of History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's talk more about these graveyards, you know, these graveyard orbits and then the ocean graveyard. So can you tell us more about the space graveyard at Point Nemo first?
Sure. So this is a spot in the Pacific Ocean where operators can kind of, it's agreed upon that they can kind of dump the waste from orbit once they've ceased to operate. And again, I want to stress that this is something that happens with, with objects that are currently being controlled. There's something called a controlled reentry, where spacecraft operators can guide those satellites into a particular space. It's this perfect spot that's incredibly far away, right, from inhabited spaces, places where, you know, from land masses, places where people could be affected. Of course, as Shelley, the person who just called in, noted, right, it's not like this is consequence free.
Yeah, there's is there a disposal fee? I mean, who maintains it, right? I mean, because, you know, you think of a garbage dump that has to be maintained.
That's a really good point, right? There currently is no, to my knowledge, any sort of maintenance in this region, of probably because it is so remote, right? Like this really is just kind of like a let's throw it there. And then of course, once it sinks, right, who's going there to go, you know, to go clean up after us. I mean, there have been, again, as particularly wealthy individuals that have, whether that was like Paul Allen or Jeff Bezos, who've kind of scrambled together missions to kind of pull up historically significant debris from the ocean, not necessarily Point Nemo, but from other points. Like, there's, I believe, an exhibit at the newly reopened Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, where I'm on a fellowship right now, that actually has a rocket engine that was brought up to the back up and is now on display. So you can see, not only kind of this object that would have been just deposited in the ocean and left there, but see the effects of the ocean environment on this object that was designed for use in outer space. So there is an occasional effort, to pull things up, but that requires those objects to have value to someone, right, with enough money and resources to bring it back up. And a lot of these objects don't have that value to those people, right? So they are waste, right? Waste is obviously something that is not immutable. It's something that can change. Whether something is waste or valuable is really in the eye of the beholder. So you can imagine that there might be a lot of things in Point Nemo that are culturally or historically significant that are just there. I mean, eventually, the Hubble Space Telescope, which I know I personally have a very, very strong feelings about, I value that object as something that kind of really sparked my love and interest in space and in astronomy, which I studied in college, right? That object, it can, now that the space shuttle is retired, it cannot be retrieved safely. It will not have an afterlife in museums like the space shuttles do. It will eventually need to be re-entered and destroyed and potentially deposited in Point Nemo with all those other artifacts of varying levels of utility and inutility, right? But like, I imagine that maybe potentially someone would want to go grab that someday. Right now, there's actually a private individual who has purchased a few flights on SpaceX rockets, who's now proposed to go up himself and boost Hubble to a higher orbit to prolong its life. But that's just, one fix. And eventually Hubble is doomed, which hurts my heart and might hurt the hearts of some listeners as well. But eventually that might land in Point Nemo as well. And you have to just wonder what kind of trove of interesting objects might be down there.
True graveyard. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. John, what would you like to bring up?
Hi. I was wondering why they blow up their satellites either with an explosive within the satellite or with a projectile instead of just incorporating a device or method where they would disable all the circuits and leave this satellite in one piece. That way, it wouldn't be spread out in all the pieces, and it would still be orbiting but inoperable instead of blowing it up.
John, thank you. Lisa Ruth, why is that?
Yes, John, thank you so much for that question. So these ASATs, they are catastrophic, they are dramatic, they are certainly news-making, but they are not the only ways, right, that a satellite can be destroyed, as you rightly bring up. These are not the only ways that the kind of state militaries can have an effect on satellites. There are less materially destructive ways to do that, such as laser or cyber attacks. This has been part of the international defense landscape for years. But these kind of unambiguous acts of aggression, right, are the ones that we kind of see a little more often, that are a little, more newsworthy, right? So, the question of why do they do it? Well, I think that the example, right, of ASATs in the recent last few decades can actually, can illustrate that, right? So I mentioned in 2007, China blew up one of its own faltering satellites, a weather satellite. And the next year, the United States did the same with a faltering Department of Defense satellite. Well, the stated reason that the United States government did that was, well, okay, this thing is dangerous. It's tumbling. It has hydrazine fuel on board. Let's make sure that it doesn't pose a threat to other satellites or to spaces on the ground. But you can sort of see the subtext there, right? That like, okay, China just did this. Let's make sure they know that we can do it too, right? That this is about kind of geopolitical power, showing that we have the ability to do this. And you better, make sure that the status quo is maintained. And the fact that the Indian ASAT in 2019 happened on the eve of a presidential election, right? This was showing India's power on the international stage. And again, the Russian ASAT taking place as it did kind of before the onset of hostilities in Ukraine, right? Like, these are all part of of acts of power or of attempts to demonstrate power in a way that something like a cyber attack or a laser attack doesn't quite do in the same dramatic fashion.
Beyond the showcasing of power, are there any proprietary technology things that they're trying to, blow up and not be seen? Or are satellites pretty basic and, you know, that wouldn't even be a consideration?
That's a great question too. So far, yeah, each of the satellites that have been targeted by ASATs in the 20th century have all been the satellites that were owned by the nations that conducted the ASATs, right? It's not like the United States blew up a Russian satellite or China blew up an Indian satellite, right? It's all been the proprietary technology of that nation.
Mm-hmm.
That said, right, there is the implication that could be done, but in terms of protecting proprietary technology, if you'll indulge it, I think I want to bring it back to Wisconsin here and that reentry over Manitowoc in 1962, because that was one of these kind of early space junk examples of early on where, you know, this was during the era during the Cold War, and the Soviet Union would not have wanted the United States to necessarily recover a piece of orbital debris, because that would mean that potentially the United States government could, you know, exploit that debris to learn proprietary technologies, like learn, mm-hmm. right, what was going on the other side of the so-called Iron Curtain and see what the Soviet space program was doing, right, and potentially exploit that to improve our own space program. So orbital debris, when we talk about the value of objects, right, whether they're valuable things in Point Nemo in the satellite graveyard, well, you know, a piece of space junk that falls into Wisconsin could be something that would be valuable, right? Potentially, if it had information that a geopolitical enemy could learn about through the accidental fall of that object in a place where it did not belong, right? So we see that there, right? That there are now kind of rules in place that require nations to return objects that have been recovered to their point of origin. We saw this recently, actually, with a piece of orbital debris that fell into Australia that turned out to be a piece of a SpaceX spacecraft that that needed to be returned to that company because it's their property, right? So that rule still exists and still has implications now.
They'll pay for the shipping, though. Assistant Professor of History Lisa Ruth Rand talking us through the history and politics of space junk, things we don't normally think about. Bring your reflections on who should manage this waste, where you think space junk is headed in the future. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at the politics of space junk as a United Nations General Assembly. They passed a resolution designed to deter nations from blowing up their satellites that contribute to the space debris problem. Call in with your questions or how you think space junk should be handled across the world. 800-642-1234. Lisa Ruth Rand is an assistant professor of history at Caltech, stays with us. Lisa Ruth, you mentioned geopolitical forces, and I'm just curious, can the U.S. and Russia and China, these major space players, cooperate on space garbage when they don't have much ability, like, you know, geopolitically here on Earth to cooperate?
I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head there, right? It's a really scary prospect. The kind of the question of, right, the fact that this is that outer space, that the orbital environment is one that is truly global in nature, one would kind of hope that would be a site where that kind of cooperation could potentially happen, because it's really in the best interests of everyone who operates in outer space and everyone whose citizenry, every place whose citizenry uses satellites, which is a mm-hmm. growing portion of the planet, right, that we would want to keep clean. So there is that, again, that supposition that goodwill should operate here. But right, outer space, unfortunately, is continuing to be, or has been increasingly, kind of part of this kind of geopolitical conflict. I mean, we really saw it with the saga of Starlink in the Ukraine conflict, where SpaceX provided access to Starlink to Ukraine, which was turned out to be a really really important tool for news for communication at, you know, between Ukraine and the rest of the world. But then, you know, when a Ukrainian leader kind of got into an online spat with Elon Musk, right, the that they threatened to take away that access, right? So we see, right, this kind of conflict happening both, you know, in terms of you know, the creation of debris in outer space, but also in just the use of outer space, that space can be a kind of a bit of a pawn in these not just national conflicts, but also kind of these conflicts between politically powerful individuals and national leaders. But right, the it's a good question that I unfortunately don't have an answer to, right? And I hope that, you know, there are policy experts that have expertise that I'm hoping will, you know, are working on this. The question is whether or not, you know, it will become something of enough
of
political value that becomes prioritized. And I mean, the time for that is well past, right? That we are in this moment of the acceleration of the space industry and the acceleration of flights and the launch tempo. And it's just the time for coming together and figuring this out is past, but you know, better late than never. So
let's, you know, and on along those lines, Michael in Brandon, Wisconsin, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, good morning. It's certainly not a new concern. I was presented with this idea in like 1977 from the band Devo. They had a song on their first album.
Yes.
Space junk. And at the time, it as a, you know, a 10-year-old kid, it seemed kind of like an oddball sort of thing. But and then there was probably, you know, maybe a few thousand pieces of junk. Now there's tens of thousands. My question is that, you know, is there approach of a garbage collector to go up there, or is that kind of a needle in the haystack kind of thing?
Michael, thank you. Short on time. Lisa, Ruth, go ahead.
Okay, I'll be right. Thank you so much for bringing Devo into the mix. Happy wave in the discussion of space junk. Yeah, that's a really great question, Michael. Thank you. There are proposals to collect garbage in outer space. NASA's, you know, done a study using gecko feet as kind of a method to biomimicry to try to like collect things without using projectiles, right? There's space harpoons, space nets, all these different proposals, and increasingly private companies are entering that market. Privateer, which was co-founded by Steve Wozniak, former co-founder of Apple, Marie Baja, who's currently a MacArthur fellow, is also on that team. A really excellent space environmentalist. I suggest you look him up. They're all kind of proposing ideas for collecting junk in outer space and bringing it back to Earth. So it shows that there's also a market for this, right?
A market for it. Yes.
Yeah.
Lisa Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Lisa Ruth Rand is an assistant professor of history at California Institute of Technology. She's a historian of science, technology, and the environment. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.